Side 12, The Hidden City, The Tomilly, Book 3, by David Eddings, continuing on page 409. "And they do their waiting in the guardroom?" Sparhawk pressed.
"Save only for the pair who stand guard at the door to thy queen's prison, and the other pair who bar the stairway which doth lead down into the lower levels of this tower.
Can they get into the queen's cell from the guardroom?" Fevrier asked intently.
"Nay. There is but one door."
"And how wide is the doorway between the guardroom and the main room?"
"Wide enough for one man only, Sir Bevier."
"Colton and I can hold that one, Sparhawk."
"Are there any other doors to the guardroom?"
Colton asked. Zenisha shook her head.
"Any large windows?"
"One window only, the mate to this one above us, though it is not barred."
"That narrows the opposition down to just those four guards in the main room," Colton said. "Bevier and I can keep the rest of them penned in for a week if we have to."
"And Sparhawk and I can deal with the ones at the cell door and the top of the stairs,"
Mirtai added.
"Let's get Talon inside that cell,"
Sparhawk said, looking again toward the east, where a faint lessening of the darkness had begun. Colton scrambled back up the wall to the window and began digging at the mortar with his heavy dagger.
"Slip around and keep watch, Anaray," Sparhawk whispered. "Let us know if anybody comes up those stairs."
She nodded and went back around the corner of the tower. Sparhawk climbed up and attacked the mortar on the left side of the iron lattice, while his friend continued to dig at the right. After a few moments, Colton took hold of the rusty iron and pulled.
"The bottom's loose," he muttered. "Let's get the top." "Right."
The two of them went to the top of the window and began to chip away the mortar there.
"Be careful when it breaks away," Sparhawk cautioned. "We don't want it clanging down on that parapet."
"This side's free," Colton whispered. "I'll hold it while you dig your side loose."
He reached inside, found a secure handhold with his right hand, and grasped the grating with his left. Sparhawk dug harder, sending a shower of chunks and dust to the parapet below.
"I think that's got it," he whispered. "We'll see."
Colton's shoulders heaved, and there was a grinding sound as the ancient grate tore loose from the wall. Then, with the same movement, Sparhawk's burly friend hurled the heavy obstruction out beyond the balustrade.
"What are you doing?"
Sparhawk choked.
"Getting rid of it." "Do you know how much noise that thing's going to make when it hits the ground?" "So what? It's 500 feet down. Let it make all the noise it wants to. If some seer guy or Senescan slave driver's standing under it, he's in for a nasty surprise. But we can live with that, can't we?"
Sparhawk pushed his head through the now unobstructed opening.
"Aelana," he whispered, "are you there?"
"Where else would I be, Sparhawk?"
"Sorry. Stupid question, I suppose. The bars are out of the way now. We're sending Talon in. Shout or something as soon as he gets the lock jammed, so that the guards can't get through the door."
"Get out of the way, Sparhawk,"
Talon said abruptly from just below.
"I can't get in there with you filling up the whole window."
Sparhawk swung himself clear of the opening, and the agile boy began to wriggle his way through. Suddenly he stopped.
"It's not working," he muttered. "Pull me back out."
"What's wrong?"
Colton demanded.
"Just pull me back out, Colton. I don't have time to explain."
Sparhawk's heart sank as he and Colton hauled the young thief back.
"Hold on for a minute."
Talon turned until he was on his side, and then he extended his arms until they were stretched out above his head.
"All right, push."
"You'll just get stuck again," Colton objected.
"Then you'll have to push harder. This is what comes of all that wholesome food, exercise, and clean living you keep pushing on me, Sparhawk. I've grown so much that I can't get my shoulders through."
He began to wriggle through the opening again.
"Push, gentlemen," he instructed.
The two of them pushed their hands against the soles of his feet.
"Harder," he grunted. "You'll tear all your skin off,"
Colton warned.
"I'm young. I heal fast. Push."
The two shoved at his feet, and with a great deal of squirming and a few muttered oaths, he was through.
"Is he all right?"
Sparhawk whispered hoarsely through the window.
"I'm fine, Sparhawk," Talon whispered back. "You'd better get moving. This won't take me very long."
Sparhawk and Colton dropped back to the parapet.
"Let's go,"
Sparhawk said shortly, and the three knights and the Aton giantess moved quickly around the narrow parapet to the south side of the tower.
Quietly, Annika. Zanisha's voice seemed to come out of nowhere. Are they stirring yet, Anare?
Sevier whispered.
Some few sounds do emanate from the guard room,
her voice replied. There were two large, unglazed windows at the front of the tower, one on each side of the broad door. Sparhawk cautiously raised his head above the lower edge of one of them and peered inside. The room, as Afriel had reported, was fairly large. It was sparsely furnished with benches, a few backless chairs, and a couple of low tables, and it was lighted with primitive oil lamps. There was a narrow door on the right side of the rear wall, with two statue-like sirgai, one on each side, guarding it. The stairway on the left side of the room, also guarded, was enclosed on three sides by a low wall. The second doorway, the one leading into the guard room, was also on the left side, not far from the top of the stairs. Sparhawk looked intently at the guards, closely studying their weapons and equipment. They were well-muscled men in archaic breastplates, crested helmets, and short leather kilts. Each had a large round shield strapped to his left arm, and each grasped an 8-foot spear in his right. They all had swords and heavy daggers belted at their waists. Sparhawk moved his head away from the window.
You'd all better take a look, he whispered to his friends.
One by one, Calton, Bevier, and Mirtai raised up slightly to peer into the room.
Is this locked, Anare?
Sparhawk whispered, pointing at the door leading out onto the parapet.
I did not think it wise to try it, Annika. Sirgai construction is crude, and methinks no door latch in the city may be attempted soundlessly.
You're probably right, he breathed. Let's pull back around the corner, he told the others,
leading them around to the east side.
It's getting lighter, Calton noted, pointing toward the horizon.
Sparhawk grunted.
We'll go in through the windows, he told them. We'd just jam up if we tried to go through the doorway anyhow.
Bevier, you and Mirtai go through the one on the far side of the door. Calton and I'll go through the one on this side.
Be careful. Those spears seem to be their primary weapon, so they've probably had lots of training with them. Get in close and fast. Take them down in a hurry, and then block that door to the guard room. We're going to have to hold those stairs, too.
I'll do that, Sparhawk, Mirtai assured him. You concentrate on getting our friends out of that cell.
Right, he agreed. As soon as they're free, I'll unleash the Bellium. That should change the odds up here significantly.
And then there was a clear voice raised in aching song that soared out above the sleeping city.
That's the signal, Calton told them. That's Aileen. Talon's finished up. Let's go. You heard him. Sparhawk said,
stepping back so that Bevier and Mirtai could get past.
I'll give the word, and we'll all go in at the same time.
Bevier and Mirtai crouched low as they ran past the window on the near side to take positions under the window beyond the door.
Stay clear of this, Anare, Sparhawk murmured to the invisible Zanisha. It's not your kind of fight.
He frowned. There was no sense of her presence nearby.
All right, Calton, he said then. Let's get to work.
The two of them silently crept forward, swords in hand, to crouch beneath the broad window. Sparhawk raised slightly to look along the parapet. Bevier and Mirtai waited tensely under the far window. He drew in a deep breath and set himself.
Now!
He shouted, setting his hand on the window ledge and vaulting through into the room. There had been 4 Sirgai inside before. Now there were 10.
They're changing the guard, Sparhawk! Bevier shouted,
swinging his deadly lakhabar in both hands. They still had the element of surprise, but the situation had drastically changed. Sparhawk swore and cut down a sirgai carrying a pail of some kind, the captive's breakfast most likely. Then he rushed the 4 confused guards milling in front of the cell door. One of them was fighting with the lock, while the other 3 tried to get into position. They were disciplined. There was no question about that. And their long spears did raise deadly problems. Sparhawk swore a savage oath and swung his heavy broadsword, chopping at the spears. Calton had moved to one side, and he was also swinging massive blows at the spears. There were sounds of fighting coming from the other side of the room, but But Sparhawk was too intent on breaking through to the guard who was trying to force the cell door to turn and look. Two of the spears were broken now, and the seer guy had discarded them and drawn their swords. The third soldier, his spear still intact, had stepped back to protect the one still feverishly struggling with the lock. Sparhawk risked a quick glance at the other side of the room, just in time to see Mirtai lift a struggling guard over her head and hurl him bodily down the stairs with a great clattering sound. Two other Sirgai lay dead or dying nearby. Bevier, even as he had in Otha's throne room in Zemok, held the door to the guardroom, while Mirtai, like some great golden cat, savaged the remaining guards at the top of the stairs. Sparhawk quickly turned his attention back to the men he faced. The Sirgai were indifferent swordsmen, and their oversized shields seriously hindered their movements. Sparhawk made a quick feint at the head of one, and the man instinctively raised his shield. Sparhawk instantly recovered, and, ducking low, drove his sword up into the gleaming breastplate. The seer guy cried out and fell back with blood gushing from the sheared gash in his armor. It was not enough. The seer guy at the cell door had abandoned his efforts to unlock it and had begun slamming his shoulder against it. Sparhawk could clearly hear the splintering of wood. Desperately, he renewed his attack. Once the seer guy broke through that door, and then, without even being forced, the door swung inward. With a triumphant shout, the seer guy who had been battering at the door drew his sword. And then he screamed as a new light flooded the room. Zanisha, blazing like the sun, stood in the doorway with one deadly hand extended. The seer guy screamed again, falling back, tangling himself in the struggles of his two comrades. Then he broke free, ran to the window, and plunged through. He was still running when he went over the balustrade with a long, despairing scream. The two other Sirgai at the cell door also fled, scurrying around the room like frightened mice.
Mirtai! Sparhawk roared. Stand clear! Let them go!
The Etana had just raised another struggling warrior over her head. She threw him down the stairs and turned sharply. Then she dodged clear to allow the demoralized Sirgai to escape.
Stand aside, Sir Knight,
Zanisha commanded Bevier.
I will bar that door, and I do vouchsafe that none shall pass.
Bevier took one look at her glowing face and stepped away from the guardroom door. The seer guy inside the room also looked at her, and then they slammed the door shut.
It's all right now, Elana, Sparhawk called.
Talon came out first, and his face was pale and shaken. The boy's tunic was ripped in several places, and a long, bleeding scrape on one arm spoke of his struggle to get through the narrow window. He was staring in awe at Zanisha.
She came through the window in a puff of smoke, Sparhawk, he choked.
Missed, young Talon,
Zanisha corrected in a clinical tone. She was still all aglow and facing the guardroom door.
Smoke would be impractical for human flesh.
There was a great deal of noise coming from the guardroom.
They seem to be moving furniture in there, Sparhawk,
Bevier laughed.
Piling it against the door, I think.
Then Aileen came running out of the cell to hurl herself into Calton's arms, and immediately behind her, Elana emerged from her prison. She was even more pale than usual, and there were dark circles under her eyes. Her clothing was tattered, and her head was tightly bound in a bandage-like wimple.
Oh, Sparhawk,
she cried in a low voice, holding her arms out to him. He went to her and enfolded her in a rough embrace. From far below there came a savage bellow.
Anika! Belium's voice roared in Sparhawk's mind. Sirgon hath awakened to his peril. Release me.
Sparhawk jerked the pouch out from under his tunic and fumbled with the drawstring.
What's that shouting?
Talon demanded.
Sirgon knows that we've released Elana,
Sparhawk replied tensely, drawing Kirik's box out of the pouch.
Open, he commanded.
The lid raised, and the blue radiance of the bellium blazed forth. Sparhawk carefully lifted out the jewel.
They're coming up the stairs, Sparhawk,
Mirtai warned.
Get clear, he said sharply.
Blue Rose, he said then, canst thou bar the way to our enemies, who even now rush up yon stairway?
The bellium did not answer. But the waist-high wall surrounding the head of the stairs collapsed, crashing down into the stairwell with a great clattering and a billowing cloud of dust.
Advise Ephriel that her mother is safe.
Belium's voice was crisp.
Let the attack begin.
Sparhawk cast the spell.
Ephriel, he said sharply, we've got Aelana. Tell the others to move in.
Can Belium break Sirgon's illusion?
She asked in a tone every bit as crisp as the sapphire roses had been. Blue Rose, Sparhawk said silently, the illusion of Sirgon doth still impede the advance of our friends upon the city. Canst thou dispel it, that they may bring their forces to bear upon this accursed place?
It shall be as thou wouldst have it, my son.
There was a momentary pause, and then the earth seemed to shudder slightly, and a vast shimmer ran in waves across the sky. From the leprous white temple far below, there came a shrill screech of pain.
My goodness! Flute said mildly, as she suddenly appeared in the center of the room. I've never had a 10,000-year-old spell broken. I'll bet it hurts like anything. Poor Sirgon's having an absolutely dreadful night.
The night is not yet over, child goddess.
Belium spoke through Colton's lips.
Save thine unseemly gloating until all danger is past.
Well, really?
Hush, Ephriel. We must look to our defenses, Annika. What Sirgon knoweth, Clell doth also know. The contest is at hand. We must make ready. Truly,
Sparhawk agreed. He looked around at his friends.
Let's go, he told them. We'll spread out along the parapet, and keep your eyes open. Clell's coming, and I don't want him creeping up behind me. Is that stairway completely blocked?
A mouse couldn't get through all that rubble,
Mirtai told him. We can forget about the guards, Bevier announced, removing his ear from the guardroom door. They're still rearranging the furniture.
Good.
Sparhawk went to the door leading out to the parapet. It opened with a shrill protest of rusty hinges.
Don't start getting brave, he cautioned his friends. The fight's between Belium and Clell. Spread out and keep watch.
The eastern sky was pale with the approach of day as they came out onto the parapet, and Sirgon's agonized shrieking still echoed through the hidden city.
There,
Talon said, pointing toward the basalt escarpment beyond the lake to the south. A mass of figures, tiny in the distance, and still dark in the dawn light, were streaming out of the Glen of Heroes, moving into the basin before the gates of Sirga.
Who are they?
Aelana cried, suddenly gripping Sparhawk's arm.
Vanyan, Sparhawk told her, along with just about everybody else. Fetwana, Kring, Ulaf, and the trolls, Sophrenia.
Sophrenia? Aelana exclaimed. She's dead. You didn't really think I'd let Zelasta kill my sister, did you, Aelana?
Flute said.
But he said that he'd stabbed her in the heart.
The child goddess shrugged.
He did, but Belium cured it. And don't worry, Vanyan's going to take steps.
Talon came running around the parapet from the back of the tower.
Brixton's coming in from the other side, he reported. His knights just trampled about 3 regiments of Sirgai underfoot without even slowing down.
Are we going to be caught in the middle of a siege here?
Colton asked with a worried expression.
Not too likely, Bevier replied. The defenses of this place are pitifully inadequate, and Patriarch Brigston tends to be a very abrupt sort of man.
There was a sudden eruption far below, and the roof of the pale temple exploded, hurling chunks of limestone in all directions as the infinite darkness of Clell shouldered his way up out of the house of Sirgon. His vast, leathery wings spread wide, and his blazing, slitted eyes looked about wildly.
Prithee, Annika, hold me aloft, that my brother may behold me.
The voice coming from Colton's lips was detached. Sparhawk's hand was shaking as he raised the sapphire rose over his head. Colton, moving somewhat woodenly, gently put Aileen's clinging arms aside and stepped to the stone rail at the front of the parapet. He spoke in a tongue no human mouth could have produced, and his words could quite probably have been heard in Kyrellos, half a world away. Enormous Clell, waist-deep in the ruins of Sirgon's temple, raised his triangular face and roared his reply, his fanged mouth dripping flame.
Attend closely, Annika.
Belium's voice in Sparhawk's mind was very quiet.
I will continue to taunt mine errant brother, and, all enraged, will he come to do battle with me. Be thou steadfast in the face of that approaching horror, for our success or failure does hang entire upon thy courage and the strength of thine arm.
I do not take thy meaning, Blue Rose. Am I to smite Clell?
Nay, Annika, thy task is to free me.
The beast of darkness below savagely kicked aside the limestone rubble and advanced on the palace with hungry arms outstretched. When he reached the massive gates, he brushed them from his path with a whip of lightning clutched in one enormous fist. Calkin continued his deafening taunts, and Clell continued to howl his fury as he crushed his way through the lower wings of the palace, destroying everything that lay in the path of his relentless drive toward the tower. And then he reached it, and seizing its rough stones in his two huge hands, he began to climb, his wings clawing at the morning air as he mounted up and up. How am I to free thee, Blue Rose? Sparhawk asked urgently.
My brother and I must be briefly recombined, my son, Belium replied, to become one again as we once were. Else must I forever be imprisoned within this azure crystal, even as Clell must remain in his present monstrous form. In our temporary combination, will we both be freed?
Combine? How?
When he doth reach this not inconsiderable height, and doth exult with resounding bellow of victory, must thou hurl me straightway into his gaping maw.
Do what?
He would with all his soul devour me. Make it so. In the moment of our union shall Clell and I both be freed of our present forms, and then shall our contest begin. Fail not, my son, for this is thy purpose, and the destiny for which I made thee.
Sparhawk drew in a deep breath.
I will not fail thee, father, he pledged with all his heart.
Still raging, and with his leathery wings straining for purchase on the wind, Clell mounted higher and higher up the front of the palace tower. Sparhawk felt a sense of odd, undismayed detachment come over him. He looked full into the face of the King of Hell and felt no fear. His task was simplicity in itself. He had only to hurl the sapphire rose into that gaping maw, and, should a suitable opportunity for that not present itself, to hurl himself, with Belium in his outstretched fist instead. He felt no regret, nor even sadness, as the unalterable resolve settled over him. Better this than to die in a meaningless, unremembered skirmish on some disputed frontier, as so many of his friends had. This had significance, and for a soldier, that was the best one could hope for. And still Clell came, climbing higher and higher, reaching hungrily for his hated brother. No more than a few yards below now, his slitted eyes blazed in cruel triumph, and his jagged fangs dripped fire as he roared his challenge. And then Sparhawk leapt atop the ancient battlement to stand poised with Belium aloft in his fist.
For God and my queen, he bellowed his defiance.
Clell reached up with one awesome hand. Then, like the sudden uncoiling of some tight-wound spring, Sparhawk struck. His arms snapped down like a whip.
Go,
he shouted as he released the blazing jewel. As true as an arrow, the sapphire rose flew from his hand, even as Clell's mouth gaped wider. Straight it went, to vanish in the flaming maw. The tower trembled as a shudder ran through the glossy blackness of the enormity clinging to its side, and Sparhawk struggled to keep his balance on his precarious perch, even as Calton fell backward to the parapet. Clell's wings stiffened to their fullest extent, quivering with awful tension. The great beast swelled, growing even more enormous. Then he contracted, shriveling. And then he exploded. The detonation shook the very earth, and Sparhawk was hurled back from the battlement to fall heavily on the parapet. He rolled quickly, came to his feet, and rushed back to the battlements. Two beings of light, one a glowing blue, the other sooty red, grappled with each other on insubstantial air not 10 feet away. Their struggle was elemental, a savage contesting of will and strength. They were featureless beings, and their shapes were only vaguely human. Heaving back and forth, They clung to each other like wrestlers in some rude village square, each bending all his will and force to subdue his perfectly matched opponent. Sparhawk and his friends lined the battlements, frozen, awed, able only to watch that primeval struggle. And then the two broke free of each other and stood, backs bowed and arms half extended, each facing his immortal brother in some inconceivable communion. "It falls to thee, Annika." Belium's voice in Sparhawk's mind was calm. "Should Fell and I continue, this world shall surely be destroyed, as hath oft time come to pass before. Thou art of this world, and must therefore be my champion. Constraints are upon thee which do not limit me. Clell's champion is also of this world, and is similarly constrained."
"It shall be even as thou hast said, my father," Sparhawk replied. "I will serve as thy champion if need be. With whom must I contend?"
A great roar of rage came from far below, and a living flame surged up out of the shattered ruins of the chalk-white temple.
"There is thine opponent, my son," the azure spirit replied. "Klell hath called him forth to do battle with thee."
"Sirgon."
"Even so."
"But he is a god."
"And art thou not?"
Sparhawk's mind reeled.
"Look within thyself, Annika. Thou art my son, and I made thee to be the receptacle of my will. I now release that will to thee, that thou mayest be the champion of this world. Feel its power infuse thee."
It was like the opening of a door that had always been closed. Sparhawk felt his mind and will expanding infinitely as the barrier went down, and with that expansion there came an unutterable calm.
"Now art thou truly Annika, my son," Belium exulted. "Thy will is now my will. All things are now possible for thee. It was thy will which vanquished Azash. I was but thine instrument. In this occasion, however, shalt thou be mine. Bend thine invincible will to the task, seize it in thine hands and mold it, forge weapons with thy mind and confront Sirgon. If thine heart be true, he cannot prevail against thee. Now go, Sirgon awaits thee."
Sparhawk drew in a deep breath and looked down at the rubble-littered square far below. The flame which had emerged from the ruins had coalesced into a blazing man-shape, standing before the wreck of the temple.
"Come, Annika," it roared. "Our meeting hath been foretold since before time began. This is thy destiny. Thou art honored above all others to fall by my hand."
Sparhawk deliberately pushed aside the windy pomposity of archaic expression.
"Don't start celebrating until after you've won, Sirgon," he shouted his reply. "Don't go away. I'll be right down."
Then he set one hand atop the battlement and lightly vaulted over it. He stopped, hanging in midair.
"Let go, Afriel," he said.
"What are you doing?" she exclaimed.
"Just do as you're told. Let me go."
"You'll fall."
"No, I won't. I can handle this. Don't interfere. Sirgon's waiting for me, so please let go."
It was not actually flying, although Sparhawk was certain that he could fly if he needed to. He felt a peculiar lightness as he drifted down toward the ruins of the house of Sirgon. It was not that he had no weight. It was more that his weight had no meaning. His will was somehow stronger than gravity. Sword in hand, he settled down and down like a fearsome drifting feather. Sirgon waited below. The burning figure of the ancient god drew his fire about him, congealing the incandescent flame into the antique armor customarily worn by those who worshipped him, a burnished steel cuirass, a crested helmet, a large round shield, and a sword in his fist. A peculiar insight came to Sparhawk as he slid down through the dawn-cool air. Sirgon was not so much stupid as he was conservative. It was change that he hated, change that he feared. Thus he had frozen his Sirgai eternally in time, and had erased any potential for change or innovation from their minds. the seer guy, unmoved by the winds of time, would remain forever as they had been when their god had first conceived of them. He had wrought an ideal and fenced it all about with law and custom and an innate hatred of change, and frozen thus they were doomed, and had been since the first of them had placed one sandaled foot on the face of the ever-changing world. Sparhawk smiled faintly. Sirgon, it appeared, needed instruction in the benefits of change, and his first lesson would be in the advantages of modern equipment, weaponry, and tactics. Sparhawk thought armor, and he was immediately encased in black enameled steel. He almost casually discarded his plain working sword and filled his hand with his heavier and longer ceremonial blade. Now he was a fully armed Pandian knight, a soldier of God, of several gods. He rather ruefully amended that thought. And he was, almost by default, the champion not only of his queen, his church, and his god, but also, if he read Belium's thought correctly, of his fair and sometimes vain sister, the world. He drifted down and settled to earth amidst the wreck of the destroyed temple. "Well met, Sirgon," he said with profoundest formality. "Well met, Annika," the god replied. "I had misjudged thee. Thou art suitable now. I had despaired of thee, fearing that thou wouldst never have realized thy true significance. Thine apprenticeship hath been long, and methinks hindered by thine inappropriate affiliation with Aphriel." "We're wasting time, Sirgon," Sparhawk cut through the flowery courtesies. "Let's get at this. I'm already late for breakfast." "So be it, Annika."
Sirgon's classic features were set in an expression of approval.
"Defend thyself!"
And he swung a huge sword stroke at Sparhawk's head. But Sparhawk had already begun his stroke, and so their swords clashed harmlessly in the air between them. It was good to be fighting again. There were no politics here, no confusion of dissembling words or false promises, just a clean, sharp ring of steel on steel and the smooth flow of muscle and sinew over bone. Sirgon was quick as Martell had been in his youth, and despite his hatred of innovation, he learned quickly. The intricate moves of wrist and arm and shoulder that marked the master swordsman seemed to come unbidden, almost in spite of himself, to the ancient god.
"Invigorating, isn't it?"
Sparhawk panted through a wolf-like grin, lashing a stinging cut at the god's shoulder.
"Open your mind, Sirgon. Nothing is set in stone, not even something as simple as this."
And he lashed out with his sword again, flicking another cut onto Sirgon's sword arm. The immortal rushed at him, forcing the oversized round shield against him, trying with will and main strength to overcome his better-trained opponent. Sparhawk looked into that flawless face and saw regret and desperation there. He bunched his shoulder, as Kirik had taught him, and locked his shield arm, forming an impenetrable barrier against the ineffectual flailing of his opponent. He parried only with his lightly held sword.
"Yield, Sirgon," he said. "And live. Yield and Clell will be banished. We are of this world, Sirgon. Let Clell and Belium contend for other worlds. Take thy life and thy people and go. I would not slay even thee."
"I spurn thine insulting offer, Annika,"
Sirgon half shrieked.
"I guess that satisfies the demands of knightly honor,"
Sparhawk muttered to himself with a certain amount of relief.
"God knows what I'd have done if you'd accepted."
He raised his sword again.
"So be it then, brother," he said. "We weren't meant to live in the same world together anyway."
He felt his body and will seem to swell inside his armor.
"Watch, brother," he grated through clenched teeth. "Watch and learn."
And then he unleashed 500 years of training, coupled with his towering anger at this poor, impotent godling who had ripped asunder the peace of the world, a peace toward which Sparhawk had yearned since his return from exile in Rendor. He ripped Sirgon's thigh with a classic Pa-4. He slashed that perfect face with Martell's innovative Parry Pa-9. He cut away the upper half of Sirgon's oversized round shield with Vanyan's third feint and slash. Of all the church knights, the Pandians were the most skilled swordsmen,
and of all the Pandians, Sparhawk stood supreme. Belium had called him the equal of a god, but Sparhawk fought as a man, superbly trained, a little out of condition, and really too old for this kind of thing, but with an absolute confidence that if the fate of the world rested in his hands, he was good for at least one more fight. His sword blurred in the light of the new-risen sun, flickering, weaving, darting. Baffled, the ancient Sirgon tried to respond. The opportunity presented itself, and Sparhawk felt the perfect symmetry of it. Sirgon, untaught, had provided the black-armored Pandian precisely the same opening Martell had given him in the Temple of Azash. Martell had fully understood the significance of the series of strokes. Sirgon, however, did not. And so it was that the thrust which pierced him through came as an absolute surprise. The god stiffened, and his sword fell from his nerveless fingers as he lurched back from that fatal thrust. Sparhawk recovered from the thrust and swept his bloody sword up in front of his face in salute. "An innovation, Sirgon," he said in a detached sort of voice. "You're really very good, you know, but you ought to try to stay abreast of things." Sirgon sagged to the flagstoned court, his immortal life spilling out through the gash in his breastplate. "And wilt thou take the world now, Annika?" he gasped. Sparhawk dropped to his haunches beside the stricken god. "No, Sirgon," he replied wearily. "I don't want the world. Just a quiet little corner of it."
"Then why camest thou against me?"
"I didn't want you to have it either. Because if you had, my little part wouldn't have been safe." He reached out and took the pallid hand. "You fought well, Sirgon. I have respect for you. Hail and farewell." Sirgon's voice was only a whisper as he replied,
"Hail and farewell, Annika."
There was a great despairing howl of frustration and rage. Sparhawk looked up and saw a man-shape of sooty red streaking upward into the dawn sky as Klel resumed his endless journey toward and beyond the farthest star. Chapter 33. There was fighting somewhere, the ring of steel on steel, and shouts and cries, but Aelana scarcely heard the sounds as she stared down at the square lying between the ruins of the temple and the only slightly less ruined palace. The sun was fully above the eastern horizon now, and it filled the ancient streets of Sirga with harsh, unforgiving light. The Queen of Alenia was exhausted, but the ordeal of her captivity was over, and she yearned only to lose herself in her husband's embrace. She did not understand much of what she had just witnessed, but that was not really important. She stood at the battlements, holding the child goddess in her arms, gazing down at her invincible champion far below. "Do you think it might be safe for us to go down?" she asked the small divinity in her arms. "The stairway's blocked, Aelana," Myrtai reminded her.
"I can take care of that," Flute said.
"Maybe we'd better stay up here," Bevier said with a worried frown. "Sirgon and Klel are gone, but Zelasta's still out there somewhere. He might try to seize the queen again so that he can use her to bargain his way out of here."
"He'd better not," the child goddess said ominously. "Aelana's right. Let's go down."
They went back inside, reached the head of the stairs, and peered down through billowing clouds of dust.
"What did you do?" Talon asked Flute. "Where did all the rocks go?"
She shrugged. "I turned them into sand," she replied. The stairway wound downward along the inside of the tower walls. Calton and Bevier, swords in hand, led the way, prudently investigating each level as they reached it. The top three or four levels were empty, but as they began the descent to a level about midway down the inside of the tower, Zanisha hissed sharply.
"Someone approaches."
"Where?" Calton demanded. "How many?"
"Two, and they do mount the stairs toward us."
"I'll deal with them," he muttered, gripping his sword hilt even more tightly.
"Don't do anything foolish," Aelene cautioned.
"It's the fellows coming up the stairs who are being foolish, love. Stay with the queen." He started on ahead.
"I'll go with him," Myrtai said. "Bevier,
It's your turn to guard Elana.
But hush, she commanded. Do as you're told.
Yes, ma'am, he surrendered with a faint smile. A murmured sound of voices came echoing up the stairs.
Centiocles,
Elana identified one of the speakers in a short, urgent whisper.
And the other?
Zenisha asked.
Ekatis. Ah,
Zenisha said, her pale brow furrowed in concentration.
This is not exact,
she apologized,
but it seemeth me that they are unaware of thy release, Queen of Alenia, and they do rush to thy former prison, hoping that by threatening thy life might they gain safe conduct through the ranks of their enemies.
There was a landing perhaps 20 steps down the narrow stairway, and Kaltin and Myrtai stopped there, stepping somewhat apart to give themselves room. Centiocles, wearing his gleaming breastplate and crested helmet, came bounding up the stairs two at a time with his sword in his hand. He stopped suddenly when he reached the landing, staring at Kaltin and Myrtai in stupefied disbelief. He waved his sword at them and issued a peremptory command in his own language.
What did he say?
Talon demanded.
He ordered them to get out of his way,
Afriel replied. Doesn't he realize that they're his enemies?
Enemy is a difficult concept for someone like Centiocles,
Elana told him.
He's never been outside the walls of Sirga, and I doubt that he's seen more than 10 people who weren't Sirgai in his entire life. The Sirgai obey him automatically, so he hasn't had much experience with open hostility.
Hecatus came puffing up the stairs behind Centiocles. His eyes were wide with shock, and his wrinkled face ashen. He spoke sharply to his king, and Centiocles placidly stepped aside. Akatis drew himself up and began speaking sonorously, his hands moving in the air before him.
Stop him, Bevier cried. He's casting a spell.
He's trying to cast a spell,
Afriel corrected.
I think he's in for a nasty surprise.
The high priest's voice rose in a long, slow crescendo, and he suddenly leveled one arm at Kaltin and Myrtai. Nothing happened. Akatis held his empty hand up in front of his face, gaping at it in utter astonishment.
Akatis,
Afriel called sweetly to him,
I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but now that Sirgon's dead, your spells won't work anymore.
He stared up at her, comprehension and recognition slowly dawning on his face. Then he spun and bolted through the door on the left side of the landing and slammed it behind him. Myrtai moved quickly after him. She briefly tried the door, then stepped back and kicked it to pieces. Kaltin advanced on the sneering king of the Sirgai. Centiocles struck a heroic pose, his oversized shield extended, his sword raised, and his head held high.
He's no match for Kaltin,
Bevier said.
Why doesn't he run? He doth believe himself invincible, Sir Bevier,
Zenisha replied.
He hath slain many of his own soldiers on the practice field, and thus considers himself the paramount warrior in all the world. In truth, however, his subordinates would not strike back or even defend themselves, because he was their king.
Kaltin, grim-faced and vengeful, fell on the feeble-minded monarch like an avalanche. The face of Centiocles was filled with shock and outrage, as, for the first time in his life, someone actually raised a weapon against him. It was a short, ugly fight, and the outcome was quite predictable. Kaltin battered down the oversized shield, parried a couple of stiffly formal swings at his head, and then buried his sword up to the hilt in the precise center of the burnished breastplate. Centiocles stared at him in sheer astonishment. Then he sighed, toppled backward off the blade, and clattered limply down the stairs.
Yes!
Elana exulted in a savage voice as the most offensive of her persecutors died. From beyond the splintered door came a long, despairing scream fading horribly away, and Myrtai emerged with an expression of bleak satisfaction.
What did you do to him? Kaltin asked curiously.
I defenestrated him, she replied with a shrug.
Myrtai, he gasped, that's awful.
She gave him a baffled look. What are you talking about?
That's a terrible thing to do to a man.
Throw him out a window? I can think of much worse things to do to somebody.
Is that what that word means?
Of course. Stragan used to talk about it back in the Therian.
Oh.
Kaltin flushed slightly. What did you think it meant?
Never mind, Myrtai.
Just forget I said anything.
You must have thought it meant something.
Let's just drop it, shall we? I misunderstood, that's all. He looked up at the others. Let's go on down, he suggested. I don't think there'll be anybody else in our way.
Elana suddenly burst into tears.
I can't,
she wailed.
I can't face Sparhawk like this.
She put one hand on the wimple that covered her violated scalp.
Are you still worrying about that? Afriel asked.
I look so awful.
Afriel rolled her eyes upward.
Let's go into that room, she suggested. I'll fix it for you, if it's so important.
Could you? Elana asked eagerly.
Of course.
The child goddess squinted at her.
Would you like to have me change the color? She asked. Or maybe make it curly?
The queen pursed her lips.
Why don't we talk about that a little?
She said. The Seneskans who manned the outer wall of the hidden city were not particularly good troops in the first place, and when the trolls came leaping out of no time to scramble up the walls toward them, they broke and ran.
Did you tell the trolls to open the gates for us?
Vanyan asked Duloth.
Yes, my lord, the Genidian replied, but it might be a little while before they remember. They're hungry right now. They'll eat breakfast first.
We have to get inside, Ulof, Sophronia said urgently. We have to protect the slave pens.
Oh, Lord, he said. I forgot about that. The trolls won't be able to distinguish slaves from Seneskans.
I'll go have a look, Khalad volunteered.
He swung down from his horse and ran forward to the massively timbered gates. After a couple moments, he came back.
It's no particular problem, Lady Sophronia, he reported. Those gates would fall apart if you sneezed on them.
What?
The timbers are very old, my lady, and they're riddled with dry rot. With your permission, Lord Vanyan, I'll take some men and rig up a battering ram. We'll knock down the gate so that we can get inside.
Of course, Vanyan replied.
Come along then, Barrett, Khalad told his friend.
That young man always manages to make me feel inadequate,
Vanyan muttered as they watched the pair ride back to rejoin the knights massed some yards to the rear.
As I remember, his father had the same effect on you,
Sophronia said. Kring came galloping back around the wall.
Friend Bergston's preparing to assault the north gate, he reported.
Send word to him to be careful, friend Kring, Betwana advised. The trolls are already inside the city, and they're hungry. It might be better if he delayed his attack just a little.
Kring nodded his agreement.
Working with trolls changes the complexion of things, doesn't it, Betwana Queen? They're very good allies in a fight, but you don't want to let them get hungry.
About 10 minutes later, Khalad and a few dozen knights dragged a large log into place before the gate, suspended it on ropes attached to several makeshift tripods, and began to pound on the rotting timbers. The gate shuddered out billows of powdery red dust and began to crumble and fall apart.
Let's go,
Vanyan called tersely to his oddly assorted army, and led the way into the city. At Sophronia's insistence, the knights went straight to the pens, freed the shackled slaves, and escorted them to safety outside the walls. Then Vanyan's force moved directly to the inner wall that protected the steep hill rising in the middle of Sirga.
How long is that likely to last, Sir Ulof?
Vanyan said, gesturing toward a cluster of ravening trolls.
It's a little hard to say, Lord Vanyan, Ulof replied. I don't think we'll get much cooperation from them as long as there are still Seneskans running up and down the streets here in the outer city, though.
Maybe it's just as well, Vanyan decided. I think we want to get to Sparhawk and the others before the trolls do.
He looked around.
Khalad, he called, tell your men to drag that battering ram up here. Let's pound down the gate to the inner city and go find Sparhawk.
Yes, my lord, Khalad replied.
The gates to the inner wall were more substantial, and Khalad's ram was pounding out great booming sounds when Patriarch Bergston came riding along the wall, accompanied by the veteran Pandian Sir Heldon, a Paloi whom Vanyan did not recognize, and a tall, lithe Aton girl. Vanyan was a bit startled to see that the Styric god Cetrus was also with them.
"What do you think you're doing, Vanyan?" Bergston roared.
"Knocking down this gate, your grace,"
Vanyan replied. That's not what I'm talking about. What in God's name possessed you to let the trolls make the initial assault?
It wasn't really a question of let, Your Grace. They didn't exactly ask for permission.
We've got absolute chaos here in the outer city. My knights can't concentrate on this inner wall because they keep running into trolls. They're in a feeding frenzy, you know. Right now they'll eat anything that moves.
Must you?
Sophrenia murmured with a shudder. Hello, Sophrenia, Bergston said. You're looking well. How much longer are you going to be with this gate, Vanyan? Let's get our people into the inner city, where all we have to worry about are the seer guy. Your allies are making my men very nervous. He looked up at the top of the inner wall, sharply outlined against the dawn sky. I thought the seer guy was supposed to be soldiers. Why aren't they manning this wall?
They're a little demoralized right now, Sophrenia explained. Sparhawk just killed their god.
He did? I thought Belium was going to do that. She sighed.
In a certain sense, it did, she said. It's a little hard to separate the two of them at this point. Afriel isn't entirely sure where Belium leaves off, and Sparhawk begins right now.
Bergston shuddered. I don't think I want to know about that, he confessed. I'm in enough theological trouble already. What about Clell?
He's gone. He was banished as soon as Sparhawk killed Sirgon.
Oh, fine, Vanyan, Bergston said with heavy sarcasm. You make me ride 1,000 leagues in the dead of winter, and the fighting's all over before I even get here.
The exercise was probably good for you, Your Grace.
Vanyan raised his voice.
How much longer, Khalad? He called.
Just a few more minutes, my lord, Sparhawk's squire replied. The timbers are starting to crack.
Good,
Vanyan said bleakly.
I want to locate Zelasta. He and I have some things to talk about. At great length.
They've all bolted, Sparhawk, Talon reported, returning from his quick survey of the ruined palace. The gates are standing wide open, and we're the only people up here.
Sparhawk nodded wearily. It had been a long night, and he was emotionally as well as physically drained. He could still, however, feel that enormous calm that had settled over him when he had at last understood the true significance of his strange relationship with Belium. There were some fleeting temptations. Curiosity, perhaps, more than anything else, the desire to experiment and test the limits of newly recognized capabilities. He deliberately repressed them.
Go ahead, Sparhawk.
Flute's voice in his mind had a slight challenge in it. He turned his head slightly to look quizzically at the ageless child standing beside his wife. Elana's face was serene as she ran her fingers through her long, pale blonde hair.
What did you want me to do? He sent the thought back.
Anything that comes into your mind.
Why?
Aren't you just the least bit curious? Wouldn't you like to find out if you can turn a mountain inside out?
I can, he replied. I don't see any reason to do something like that, though.
You're hateful, Sparhawk, she suddenly flared.
What's your problem, Afriel?
You're such a lump.
He smiled gently at her.
I know. But you love me anyway, don't you?
Sparhawk, Calton called from the ornate bronze gate. Vanyan's coming up the hill. He's got Bergston with him.
Vanyan had known Sparhawk since his novitiate, but the weary-looking man in black armor seemed to be almost a stranger. There was something about his face and in his eyes that had never been there before. The preceptor approached his old friend with Patriarch Bergston and Sophrenia with a sense of something very close to awe. As soon as Elana saw Sophrenia, she ran to her with a low cry and embraced her fiercely.
I see that you've wrecked another city, Sparhawk, Bergston said with a broad grin. That's getting to be a habit, you know.
Good morning, Your Grace, Sparhawk replied. It's good to see you again.
Did you do all this?
Bergston gestured at the ruined temple and the half-collapsed palace.
Clell did most of it, Your Grace.
The hulking churchman squared his shoulders.
I've got orders from you from Dolmont, he said. You're supposed to turn the Belium over to me. Why don't you do that now, before we both forget?
I'm afraid that isn't possible, Your Grace, Sparhawk sighed. I don't have it anymore.
What did you do with it?
It no longer exists, at least not in the shape it was before. It's been freed from its confinement to continue its journey.
You released it without consulting the church? You're in trouble, Sparhawk.
Oh, do be serious, Bergston, Afriel told him. Sparhawk did what had to be done. I'll explain to Dolmont later.
Vanyan, however, had something else on his mind.
This is all very interesting, he said bleakly. But right now, I'm far more concerned about finding Zelasta. Does anybody have any idea of where he went?
He might be under all that, Vanyan, Ilana told him, pointing at the ruined temple. He and Akatis were going there when they discovered that Sparhawk was here inside the walls of Sirga. Akatis escaped, and Mirtai killed him. But Zelasta might have been crushed when Krell exploded the place.
No, Afriel said shortly. He's nowhere in the city.
I really want to find him, Divine One, Vanyan said.
Cetris, dear, Afriel said sweetly to her cousin, would you see if you can find Zelasta for me? He has a great deal to answer for.
I'll see what I can do, Afriel, the handsome god promised. But I really ought to get back to my studio. I've been letting my own work slide during all this.
Please, Cetris, she wheedled,
unleashing that devastating little smile. He laughed helplessly. Do you see what I was talking about, Bergston? He said to the towering patriarch. She's the most dangerous creature in the universe.
So I've heard, Bergston replied. You'd probably better go ahead and do as she asks, Cetris. You'll do it in the end, anyway.
Ah, there you are, Etania Ambassador,
Vanyan heard Etana Maris say in a deceptively pleasant tone of voice. He turned and saw the lithe young commander of the garrison at Sinestra descending on the clearly apprehensive Tommel diplomat.
I've been looking all over for you, she continued. We have a great deal to talk about. Somehow not one of your letters reached me. I think you should reprimand your messenger.
Itania's face took on a trapped expression. Betwana dispatched runners to Matherian just before noon, when the last of the demoralized Sirgai capitulated. Sir Ulaf made some issue of the fact that what had happened to the Seneskans in the outer city might have influenced their decision to surrender to some degree. Patriarch Bergston had taken to looking at his countrymen with a critical and speculative eye. Bergston was a rough-and-ready churchman, willing to bend all sorts of rules in the name of expediency. But he choked just a bit on Ulaf's unbridled ecumenicism.
He's just a little too enthusiastic, Sparhawk, the huge patriarch declared. All right, I'll grant you that the trolls were sort of useful, but...
He groped for a way to express his innate prejudices. There's a rather special kinship between Ulaf and Blockuf, Your Grace. Sparhawk sidestepped the issue. How much have we got left to do here? I'd sort of like to get my wife back to civilization.
You can leave now, Sparhawk, Bergston said with a shrug. We can take care of cleaning up here. You didn't leave very much for the rest of us to worry about. I'll stay here with the knights to finish rounding up the seer guy. Takumi will take his Poloi back to Sinestra to help Itania and Etana Maris set up the occupation, and Betwana is going to send her Etans into Arjuna to re-establish imperial authority.
He made a sour face.
There's nothing really left but all the niggling little administrative details. You've robbed me of a very good fight, Sparhawk.
I can send for more of Klel's soldiers if you want, Your Grace.
No, that's all right, Sparhawk. Bergston replied quickly. I can live without any more of those fights. You'll be going straight back to Matherian?
Not straight back, Your Grace. Courtesy obliges us to escort Anarae's Anisha back to Delphaeus.
She's a very strange lady, Bergston mused. I keep catching myself just on the verge of genuflection every time she enters a room.
She has that effect on people, Your Grace. If you really don't need us here, I'll talk with the others, and we'll get ready to leave.
What actually happened, Sparhawk? Bergston asked directly. I have to make a report to Dolmont, and I can't make much sense out of what the others have been telling me.
I'm not sure I can explain it, Your Grace, Sparhawk replied. Belium and I were sort of combined for a while. It needed my arm, I guess. It was an easy answer, and it evaded a central issue that Sparhawk was not yet fully prepared to even think about.
You were just a tool, then?
Brigston's look was intent. Sparhawk shrugged.
Aren't we all, Your Grace? We're the instruments of God. That's what we get paid for.
Sparhawk, you're right on the verge of heresy here. Don't throw the word God around like that.
No, Your Grace, Sparhawk agreed. It's just a reflection of the limitations of language. There are things that we don't understand and don't have names for. We just lump them all together, call it God, and let it go at that. You and I are soldiers, Patriarch Bergston. We get paid to hit the ground running when somebody blows a trumpet. Let Dolmont sort it out. That's what he gets paid for. Sparhawk and his friends, accompanied by Kring, Betwana, and Engessa, rode out of Shattered Sirga shortly after dawn the following morning, bound for Sarna. Sparhawk had neither seen nor heard from Belium since his encounter with Sirgon, and he felt a peculiar sense of disappointment about that. The troll gods had also departed with their children, all except for Blockoth, who shambled along between Ulof and Tinian. Blockoth was evasive about his reasons for accompanying them. They rode northeast across the barren wastes of Seneska, traveling in easy stages. The urgent need for haste was gone now. Sifrinia and Zanisha, once again working in concert, had returned all the faces to their rightful owners, and things were slowly settling back to normal. It was about mid-morning, 10 days after they had left Sirga, and when they were but a few leagues from Sarna, that Vanyan rode forward to join Sparhawk at the head of the column.
"A word with you, Sparhawk?"
he said.
"Of course.
It's sort of private."
Sparhawk nodded, turned the column over to Bevier, and nudged Farron into a rolling canter. He and Vanyan slowed again when they were about a quarter of a mile ahead of the others.
"Sifrinia wants us to get married," Vanyan said, cutting past any preamble.
"You're asking my permission?"
Vanyan gave him a long, steady look.
"Sorry," Sparhawk apologized. "You took me by surprise. There are problems with that, you know. The church will never approve, and neither will the Thousand of Styricum. We're not quite as hidebound as we used to be, but the notion of interracial or interfaith marriage still raises some hackles."
"I know," Vanyan said glumly. "Dolmont probably wouldn't have any personal objections, but his hands are tied by church law and doctrine."
"Who are you going to get to officiate, then?"
"Sifrinia has already solved that problem. Zanisha's going to perform the ceremony."
Sparhawk nearly choked on that.
"She is a priestess, Sparhawk."
"Well, technically, I suppose."
Then Sparhawk suddenly broke out laughing.
"What's so funny?"
Vanyan demanded truculently.
"Can you imagine the look on Ortsel's face when he hears that a preceptor of one of the four orders, a patriarch of the church, has been married to one of the Thousand of Styricum by a Delphaic priestess?"
"It does violate a few rules, doesn't it?"
Vanyan conceded with a wry smile.
"A few? Vanyan, I doubt that you could find any single act that'd violate more."
"Do you object to?"
"Not me, old friend. If this is what you and Sifrinia want, I'll back the two of you all the way up to the hierocracy."
"Would you stand up with me, then? During the ceremony, I mean?"
Sparhawk clapped him on the shoulder.
"I'd be honored, my friend."
"Good. That'll keep it all in the family. Sifrinia has already spoken to your wife about it. Elana is going to stand with her."
"Somehow I almost knew that was coming." Sparhawk laughed.
They passed through Sarna and proceeded north along a snow-clogged mountain trail toward Dirgis in southern Aton. After they left Dirgis, they turned westward again and rode higher into the mountains. "We're leaving a very wide trail behind us, Sparhawk," Bevier said late one snowy afternoon, "and the trail's leading directly to Delphaeus." Sparhawk turned and looked back.
"You've got a point," he conceded.
Maybe I'd better have a talk with Afriel. Things have changed a bit, but I don't think the Delphi are quite ready to welcome crowds of sightseers.
He turned Farron around and rode back to join the ladies. Afriel, as usual, rode with Sophronia.
A suggestion, divine one?
Sparhawk said tentatively.
You sound just like Tinian.
He ignored that.
How good are you with weather? He asked.
Did you want it to be summer?
No. Actually, I want a moderate-sized blizzard. We're leaving tracks in the snow behind us, and the tracks are pointing right straight at Delphaeus.
What difference does that make?
The Delphae might not want unannounced visitors.
There won't be any, announced or otherwise. You promised to seal their valley, didn't you?
Oh, God, he said. I'd forgotten about that. This is going to be a problem. I don't have Bellium anymore.
Then you'd better try to get in touch with it, Sparhawk. A promise is a promise, after all. Zanisha's kept her part of the bargain, so you're morally obliged to keep yours.
Sparhawk was troubled. He rode off some distance into a thick grove of spindly sapling pines and dismounted.
Blue Rose, he said aloud,
not really expecting an answer.
Blue Rose?
I hear thee, Annika.
The voice in his mind responded immediately.
I had thought thou might be in some way discontent with me.
Never that, Blue Rose. Thou hast fulfilled, or exceeded, all that I did require of thee. Our enemies are overthrown, and I am content. I did, however, pledge mine honor to the Delphae in exchange for their aid. I am obliged to seal up their valley that none of this world may come upon them.
I do recall thy pledge, Annika. It was well given. Soon, however, it will not be needful.
Thy meaning escapes me.
Watch then, my son, and learn.
There was a lengthy pause.
It is not mine intent to offend, but why hast thou brought this to me?
I gave my word that I would seal their valley, father.
Then seal it.
I was not certain that I could still speak with thee to entreat thine aid.
Thou hast no need of aid, Annika, not mine nor that of any other. Did not thine encounter with Sirgon convince thee that all things are possible for thee? Thou art Annika and my son, and there is none other like thee in all the starry universe. It was needful to make thee so, that my design might be accomplished. Whatsoever thou couldst do through me, thou couldst as easily have done with thine own hand.
The voice paused.
I am, however, somewhat pleased that thou wert unaware of thine ability, for it did give me some opportunity to come to know thee. I shall think often of thee in my continuing journey. Let us proceed to Delphaeus, where thy comrade Vanyan and our dearly loved Sophronia will be joined, and where thou wilt behold a wonder.
Which particular wonder is that, Blue Rose?
'Twould hardly be a wonder for thee, shouldst thou know of it in advance, my son.
There were faint traces of amusement in the voice, as the sense of Bellium's presence faded. It was early on a snowy evening, when they crested a ridge and looked down into the valley where the glowing lake, misty in the swirling snowflakes, shone with a light almost like that of the moon. Ancient Sedon awaited them at the rude gate to this other hidden city, and standing beside him was Itania's friend, Ecrasius. They talked until quite late, for there was much to share. It was mid-morning of the following day before Sparhawk awoke in the oddly sunken bedroom he shared with his wife. It was one of the peculiarities of Delphaic construction that the floors of most of their rooms were below ground level. Sparhawk didn't give it much thought, but Halad had seemed quite intrigued by the notion. Sparhawk gently kissed his still-sleeping wife, slipped quietly from their bed, and went looking for Vanyan. He remembered his own wedding day, and he was quite sure that his friend was going to need some support. He found the silvery-haired preceptor talking with Talon and Halad in the makeshift stable. Halad's face was bleak.
"What's the problem?" Sparhawk asked as he joined them.
"My brother's a little unhappy," Talon explained.
He talked with Ecrasius and the other Delphae who dispersed Scarpa's army down in Arjuna, and nobody could tell him one way or the other about what happened to Krager.
I'm going to operate on the theory that he's still alive, Khalad declared. He's just too slippery not to have escaped.
We have plans for you, Khalad, Vanyan told him. You're too valuable to spend your whole life trying to chase down a weaselly drunkard who may or may not have gotten out of Natayos alive.
It won't take him all that long, Lord Vanyan, Talon said. As soon as Stragan and I get back to Samura, we'll talk with Platymi, and he'll put out the word. If Krager's still alive, anywhere in the world, we'll find out about it.
What are the ladies doing? Vanyan asked nervously.
Aelana's still asleep, Sparhawk replied. Are you and Sophronia going back to Mytherian with us when we leave here?
Briefly, Vanyan replied. Sophronia wants to speak with Sarabian about a few things. Then we'll go back to Aton with Betwana and Engessa. It's only a short trip from there to Sarsos. Have you noticed what's going on between Betwana and Engessa, by the way?
Sparhawk nodded.
Evidently, Betwana's decided that the Aetons need a king. Engessa's suitable, and he's probably a great deal more intelligent than Andril was.
That's not saying too much for him, Sparhawk, Talon said with a broad grin. Andril was hardly any more intelligent than a brick.
The day wore on. The ladies, of course, made extended preparations. The knights, on the other hand, did what they could to keep Vanyan's mind occupied. An obscure tenet of the Delphaic faith dictated that the ceremony take place on the shore of the glowing lake just at dusk. Sparhawk dimly perceived why this might be appropriate for the Shining Ones, but the wedding of Vanyan and Sophronia had little, if anything, to do with the covenant between the Delphae and their god. Courtesy, however, dictated that he keep his opinions to himself. He did offer to clothe Vanyan in traditional black Pandian armor, but the preceptor chose instead to wear a white styric robe.
"I've fought my last war, Sparhawk," he said a bit sadly. "Dolmat won't have any choice but to excommunicate me and strip me of my knighthood after this. That makes me a civilian again. I never really enjoyed wearing armor all that much anyway."
He looked curiously at Uloth and Tinian, who were talking earnestly with Blocka just outside the stable door.
"What's going on there?"
"They're trying to explain the concept of a wedding to their friend. They aren't making very much headway."
"I don't imagine that trolls set much store in ceremonies."
"Not really. When a male feels that way about a female, he takes her something, or somebody, to eat. If she eats it, they're married."
"And if she doesn't?"
Sparhawk shrugged.
"They usually try to kill each other."
"Do you have any idea of why Blockus didn't go off with the rest of the trolls?"
"Not a clue, Vanyan. We haven't been able to get a straight answer out of him. Evidently, there's something the troll gods want him to do."
The afternoon dragged on, and Vanyan grew more and more edgy with each passing moment. Inevitably, however, the gray day slid into a grayer evening, and dusk settled over the hidden valley of Delphaeus. The path from the city gate to the edge of the lake had been carefully cleared, and Afriel, who was not above cheating on occasion, had strewn it with flower petals. The Delphae, all aglow and singing an ancient hymn, lined the sides of the path. Vanyan waited at the edge of the lake with Sparhawk, and the other members of their party stood in smiling anticipation as Sophronia, with Aelana at her side, emerged from the city to walk down to the shore.
"Courage, my son," Sparhawk murmured to his old friend.
"Are you trying to be funny?"
"Getting married doesn't really hurt, Vanyan."
It happened when the bride and her attendant were perhaps halfway to the lakeshore. A sudden cloud of inky darkness appeared at the edge of the snow-covered meadow, and a great voice bellowed, "No!" Then a spark of incandescent light emerged from the center of the cloud and began to swell ominously, surging and surrounded by a blazing halo of purplish light. Sparhawk recognized the phenomenon.
"I forbid this abomination," the great voice roared.
"Zalasta!"
Calton exclaimed, staring at the rapidly expanding sphere. The styric was haggard, and his hair and beard were matted. He wore his customary white robe and held his polished staff in his trembling hands.
he stood inside the glowing sphere, surrounded by its protective nimbus. Sparhawk felt an icy calm descending over him as he prepared his mind and spirit for the inevitable confrontation.
"I have lost you, Sephrenia," Zelasta declared, "but I will not permit you to wed this Aline."
Athriel dashed to her sister, her long black hair flying and a look of implacable determination on her small face.
"Fear not, Athriel," Zelasta said, speaking in formal spirit. "I have not come to this accursed place to pit myself against thee or thine errant sister. I speak for Spiricum in this matter, and I have come to prevent this obscene sham of a ceremony which will befoul our entire race."
He straightened and pointed an accusing finger at Sephrenia.
"I abjure thee, woman. Turn away from this unnatural act. Go out from here, Sephrenia of Ilara. This wedding shall not take place."
"It will," Sephrenia's voice rang out. "You cannot prevent it. Go away, Zelasta. You lost all claim on me when you tried to kill me."
She raised her chin.
"And have you come to try again?"
"No, Sephrenia of Ilara. That was the result of a madness that came over me. There is yet another way to prevent this abomination."
And he quickly turned, leveling his deadly staff at Vanyan. A brilliant spark shot from the tip of the staff, sizzling in the pale evening light. Straight as an arrow it flew, carrying death and all Zelasta's hatred. But vigilant Annika was ready, having already surmised at whom Zelasta would direct his attack. The deadly bolt flew straight, but agile Annika stretched forth his hand to subdue it. He grasped the spark and saw its fury spurting out between his fingers. Then, like a small boy throwing a stone at a bird, he hurled it back to explode against the surface of the blazing sphere.
"Well done, my son," Belium's voice applauded.
Zelasta flinched violently within his protective sphere. Pale and shaken, he stared at the dreadful form of Belium's child. Methodical Annika raised his hand, palm outward, and began to chip away at the blazing envelope that protected the desperate spirit with bolt after bolt of the kind of force that creates suns, noting almost absently as he did that the wedding guests were scattering and that Sophrenia was rushing to Vanyan's side. As he whipped out that force again and again, curious Annika studied it, testing its power, probing for its limits. He found none. Implacable Annika advanced on the deceitful Styric, who had been ultimately the cause of a lifetime of suffering and woe. He knew that he could obliterate the now terrified sorcerer with a single thought. He chose not to. Vengeful Annika moved forward, savaging the Styric's last desperately erected defenses, cutting them away bit by bit, and brushing aside Zelasta's pitiful efforts to respond.
"Annika, it is not right!"
The voice spoke in Trollish. Puzzled Annika turned to look. It was Blockus, and Belium's child had respect for the shaggy priest of the troll gods.
"This is the last of the wicked ones," Blockus declared. "It is the wish of Quadge to cause hurt to it. Will the child of the flower gem hear the words of Quadge?"
Troubled Annika considered the words of the priest of the troll gods.
"I will hear the words of Quadge," he said. "It is right that I should do this, for Quadge and I are packmates."
The enormity of the fire god appeared, steaming away the snow covering the meadow around him.
"Will Belium's child be bound by the word of his packmate, Ulaf from Thalesia?"
he demanded in a voice that roared like a furnace.
"The word of Ulaf from Thalesia is my word, Quadge,"
Honorable Annika conceded.
"Then the wicked one is mine."
Regretful Annika curbed his wrath.
"The words of Quadge are right words," he agreed. "If Ulaf from Thalesia has given the wicked one to Quadge, then I will not say that it shall not be so."
He looked at the terrified Styric, who was struggling desperately to retain some small measure of defense.
"It is yours, Quadge. It has caused me much hurt, and I would cause hurt to it in return. But if Ulaf from Thalesia has said that it is the place of Quadge to cause hurt to it, then so be it." "Belium's child speaks well.
You have honor, Annika.
The fire god looked accusingly at Zelasta.
You have done great wickedness, one called Zelasta.
Zelasta stared at Quaj in terrified incomprehension.
Say to it what I have said, Annika,
Quaj requested.
It must know why it is being punished.
Courteous Annika said, I will, Quaj. He looked sternly at the disheveled Styrek.
You have caused me much pain, Zelasta, he said in a dreadful voice, speaking in Styrek. I was going to repay you for all those friends of mine you destroyed or corrupted, but Quaj here has laid claim to you, and I'm going to honor his claim. You should have stayed away, Zelasta. Vanyan would have hunted you down eventually, but death is a little thing, and once it's over, it's over. What Quaj is going to do to you will last for eternity.
Does it understand?
Quaj demanded. In some measure, Quaj.
In time it will understand more, and it has much time. It has always.
And the dreadful fire god moved forward, blew away Zelasta's last pitiful defenses, and laid a strangely gentle hand on the cringing Styrek's head.
Burn,
he commanded.
Run and burn until the end of days.
And all aflame, Zelasta of Styrekum went out from that place, shrieking and engulfed in endless fire. Compassionate Annika sighed as he watched the burning man run out across the snowy meadow, growing smaller and smaller in the distance, and with his cries of agony and woe and unspeakable loneliness receding with him as he began the first hour of his eternal punishment. Epilogue. The following day dawned clear and cold. The sun on the snowfields blanketing the surrounding mountains was dazzling, and the lake at the center of the hidden valley of Delphaeus steamed. The wedding had been postponed, of course, and was now to take place this evening. There had been questions, naturally, but Sparhawk had put them to rest by explaining that everything that had happened had been Belian's doing, and that he had only been its instrument. Which was not exactly a lie. They spent the day quietly, and gathered again as the sun went down and the shadows of evening settled over the valley. A strange sense of anticipation had nagged at Sparhawk all afternoon. Something was going to happen here. Belium had told him that he would behold a wonder, and that was not the kind of word Belium would use lightly. The shadows of evening deepened, and Sparhawk and the other men escorted Vanyan down to the shore of the glowing lake to await the bride's party, while the Shining Ones once again sang the ancient hymn which had been so abruptly broken off the previous evening. Then the bride appeared at the gates, with the Queen of Alenia at her side and the other ladies close behind them. The child goddess, whirling and dancing in the air, and with her clear voice raised in flute song, preceded them, again strewing their path with flower petals. Sophrenia's face was serene as she came down the path to the lake. As the small Styrek bride approached the man whom two major religions had forbidden her to marry, her personal goddess provided a visible symbol that she, at least, approved. The stars had just begun to appear overhead, and one of them seemed to have lost its way. Like a tiny comet, a brilliant spark of light descended over the radiant Sophrenia and settled gently on her head as a glowing garland of spring flowers. Sparhawk smiled gently. The similarity to the crowning of Myrtai during her rite of passage was a little too obvious to miss.
Critic,
Afriel's voice accused. I didn't say anything.
Well, don't.
Sophrenia and Vanyan joined hands as the Delphaic hymn swelled to a climax, and then Zanisha, all aglow and accompanied by two other glowing forms, one white and the other blue, came walking across the lake. A yearning kind of murmur passed through the Delphae. And, as one, they sank reverently to their knees. The Anarae tenderly embraced her Styrek sister, and kissed Vanyan chastely on the cheek.
I have entreated beloved Eudamus to join with us here, and to bless this most happy union,
she told the assemblage.
And he hath brought with him this other guest, who also hath some interest in our ceremony.
Is that blue one who I think it is? Colton muttered to Sparhawk. Oh, yes, Sparhawk replied. That's the form it took back in Sirga, remember? After I stuffed it down Clell's throat. I was a little distracted at that point. Is that what it really looks like? After you peel off all the layers of sapphire, I mean? I don't really think so. Bellion's a spirit, not a form. I think this particular shape is just a courtesy, for our benefit. I thought it had already left. No, not quite yet.
The glowing form of Eudemus straightened, somehow managing to look uncomfortable. Zanisha's face hardened, and her eyes narrowed.
I had thought ill of thee, Sophrenia of Ilara, the god of the Delphi admitted. Mine Anarae hath persuaded me that my thought was in error. I do entreat thee to forgive me.
Gentle Zanisha, it appeared, was not above a certain amount of bullying. Sophrenia smiled benignly.
Of course I forgive thee, divine Eudemus. I was not entirely blameless myself, I do confess. Let us all then pray to our separate gods to bless the union of this man and this woman,
Zanisha said in formal tones.
For methinks it doth presage a new birth of understanding and trust for all of mankind.
Sparhawk was a little dubious about that, but like the others, he bowed his head. He did not, however, direct his words to his Aline god. Blue Rose, he sent out his thought.
Art thou praying, my son?
The answering voice sounded slightly amused.
Consulting, Blue Rose, Sparhawk corrected. Others will direct our entreaty to our Aline god, and I do perceive that the time fast approaches when thou and I must part.
Truly.
I thought to take this opportunity to ask a boon of thee.
If it be within my power.
I have seen the extent of thy power, Blue Rose, and in some measure shared it. It is uncandid of thee to suggest that there are any limits to what thou canst do.
Be nice, Bellion murmured.
It seemed to have become quite fond of that particular phrase.
What is this boon, my son?
I do entreat thee to take all thy power with thee when thou dost depart. It is a burden I am unprepared to accept. I am thy son, Blue Rose, but I am also a man. I have neither the patience nor the wisdom to accept responsibility for what thou hast bestowed upon me. This world which thou hast made hath gods in plenty. She doth not need another.
Think, my son. Think of what thou dost propose to surrender.
I have, my father. I have been Annika, for it was needful.
Sparhawk struggled for a way to put his feelings into archaic Alenic.
When I did as Annika confront the Styric Zelasta, I did feel a great detachment within myself, and that detachment abideth within me still. It seemeth me that thy gift hath altered me, making me more or less than a man. I would, and it pleased thee, no longer be patient Annika, or curious Annika, or implacable Annika. Annika's task is finished. End of side 12. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.